Latido de lunes a jueves. You
the Safari Park. You're killing me, Larry.
Larry, fucking Larry.
Larry from That Larry Show.
For men with balls.
Take off your pants.
Larry, get into bed now.
Larry.
Larry. Larry.
Can you believe it? That Larry Show is 6 years old this week. How did that happen? One show at a time. Episode 1 was posted this week in 2016, and when I recorded it, I gave no thought at all to Episode 2. But the reaction to Episode 1 was so positive and immediate, I got to work on Episode 2, New Year's with the Mob. That's when the world was introduced to my Cosa Nostra pal, Tony Spumante, of course not his real name. Tony turned out to be, without question, the most beloved character by far. But that first episode, I had no idea what I wanted to say. How did I get into podcasting? Well, I'd done some terrestrial radio in New York and L.A., and I loved it. But I never gave it a full-time go, always moonlighting or under a fake name. I was a late-night news guy in L.A. for a while, Larry McHale. In New York, I wrote for a very famous morning drive team and did celebrity voice impressions. Eventually, I was fired from that gig by Frank Sinatra. Not directly. He had people for that. But that's a story for another show.
Larry, stay on task.
Thank you. When I first heard about podcasting, maybe, I don't know, 15 years ago, I was immediately intrigued. No program director standing over your shoulder telling you what to say. No interminable staff meetings. Say what you want, when you want, and listeners listen when they want. Zero barriers on content and zero barriers between the show and listeners. Fantastic. So I bought a book. Podcasting for Dummies. I guess I was several notches below dummy, as it completely baffled me. Only some engineer could understand it. It was all RSS feeds and where to point your DNS servers and all this tech shit that just gave me a headache, so I said, fuck it. There were no syndicating companies to handle distribution, as there are now. Then a friend who just had launched his podcast asked me to co-host with him for several episodes. It was fun, and when I asked him about the technical side, it had become a hell of a lot easier. So, I found an old beaten-up microphone in a drawer, attached it to a camera tripod with gaffer's tape, and plugged it into a Tascam digital recorder. I said what I said and put the mini SD card into my laptop, downloaded Audacity, and struggled to edit the thing. It was a bitch. It was a long way from perfect, but at least there was no feedback, and I could be understood. The highlight of that first show was selecting the worst Christmas song of all time. First runner-up was Wonderful Christmas Time by Paul McCartney. God knows how many aneurysms that has triggered. The runaway winner was and is that funereal dirge, the Charlie Brown Christmas song. I followed it up by helping Charlie through his assisted suicide. I felt it had to be done. I never liked Charlie Brown. It was never funny. It was projecting adult neuroses onto deformed kids who never changed their clothes and had both eyes on the same side of their heads. Charlie was a defeatist loser. Lucy was a controlling, scheming bitch. Only the Beagle was likable. So I was more than happy to help Charlie out of his misery. Here's how it went down.
I think there must be something wrong with me, Linus. Christmas is coming, but I'm not happy. I don't feel the way I'm supposed to feel.
Oh, Charlie, that's terrible.
I just don't understand Christmas, I guess. I like getting presents and sending Christmas cards and decorating trees and all that, but I'm still not happy.
Oh.
I always end up feeling depressed.
Oh, Charlie, listen. I've got a way to make this all better. Let's go get you in a warm tub and Let me sing you a little song.
Christmas time is filled with pain. It never snows, it only rains. You never got those electric trains that Santa promised you. You're only 8 and filled with hate. An outcast no one likes. Snoopy's dead, so let's move ahead. It's time to end your life. You wear the same Crayola shirt. Each day is just the same. You're nearly bald and melon-shaped. You've never won a game. Here's a fistful of Nembutal. Just take them one by one. Soon you'll find you're somewhere else. It's less messy than a gun. No more Lucy, no more school, no more gloomy days. Put your head back and close your eyes and fade into the haze. Good night, Charlie. Goodbye. Goodbye now. Bye.
The next Christmas, 2017, I was again musically inspired by the spate of cancellations, huh? The big kahuna was Harvey Weinstein. But there were lots of others crushed by hashtag me too. Matt Lauer. The Prairie Home Companion guy, Garrison Keillor. Commie fucktard Al Franken, and others. My vocalization was inspired by the fantastic Lou Rawls. Here's how it played.
You better not blame. You better not whine, don't be pointing your finger, I'm telling you why, cause Scandal Claus is coming to town. Whether Weinstein or Spacey, or Louis C.K., Franken or Ratner, or Georgia Takei, ooh, Scandal Claus is coming to town. Ooh, he sees you when you're groping, and he knows what's on your mind. What you thought you got away with, he will shove up your behind. You grabbed a little ass, made a naughty joke. Maybe you gave somebody a poke. And now, Scandal Claus is coming to town. Hey now, Charlie Rose, don't be treating those ladies like hoes. Garrison Keillor, if you've been copping some feelers, you'll be wishing your woes be gone. Hey, Matty Lauer, why so dour? Welcome to the world of girl power. Geraldo's so flirty, but he's also kinda dirty. It's the name and shame, and get yourself some treatment game. He sees you when you're playing, maybe playing with yourself. And if you made somebody watch, he gonna put you on that shelf. Don't be dropping no roofies in nobody's drink, or sneaking up behind them at the kitchen sink, cause Scandal Claus is coming to town. You better be good and keep your fly zip, cause if and you don't, you'll be sorry as sh**, cause Scandal Claus is coming. Scandal Claus is coming. Scandal Claus is coming. He's coming, he's coming, he's coming. Oh, Scandal Claus is coming to town. Look out.
I've been writing songs and song parodies since I was a small kid. So these are labors of love. I never liked Neil Young. So when he declared himself a vax Nazi, all in on mandates and demanding Joe Rogan be muzzled, I took him apart with the song Heart of Compliance. You can find that in episode 347 in the February 2022 tab at thatlarryshow.com. The very next week, some of his pals from Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young announced their solidarity with Nuggetory Neil, so I hosed them with my version of Teach Your Sheeple. That's in episode 348. And so this Christmas, we've got Joey. He's really a self-parody, but that's no reason to cut him slack. He's a liar and a prick, and has ruined thousands of lives with his mandates. So for Joey, I believe I have done my best work ever, and I'll close this episode with that song. People sometimes ask me, how the hell do you do what you do? Well, ensemble podcasts are comparatively easy. If there's somebody else, or three or four people with you, that takes off a ton of pressure. But doing it solo, and there are very few solo shows out there, that's why, well, that's not so easy. I'm also frequently asked where my ideas come from, and my answer is, they come from inside my head, otherwise they would not be my ideas. But anything can trigger an idea. I rarely watch TV. Never any network shit, sitcoms, or dramas. I'd rather roll around naked on broken glass. But I do look occasionally at those crazy murder tales like 48 Hours or Dateline. As long as the courtroom stuff is kept to a minimum, I can't take that shit. Caine Mutiny, A Few Good Men, those are fucking migraines in the making. All that Your Witness and Your Honor and procedural shit, it just makes me ill. So they had one on Unsolved Mysteries. Was it Netflix, Amazon? I don't know. But it was about a local celeb in Vegas named Buffalo Jim. The guy ran a successful car repair shop, and he was also a wrestler. And it seemed he was quite beloved in Vegas until he wound up dead in a Motel 6 under very suspicious circumstances. As we watched, I remarked to my wife that I once stayed at that very same Motel 6. Of course, she was immediately irked. What the hell was I doing in a Motel 6 in Vegas? Well, it was years before I knew her. I was out there with some friends to see a big fight. It was a spur-of-the-moment thing. Back then, you could fly round-trip to Vegas on Southwest for something stupid like $45. Somebody scored tickets to the fight, but every hotel on the strip was booked solid, so Motel 6 it was. Who gave a shit? None of us wound up dead. As this unsolved mystery unfolded, it turned out that Buffalo Jim's auto repair shop was right next door to the most famous strip joint in Vegas, the Crazy Horse 2. My wife was still simmering. She said, I suppose you were in that place, too. I answered, yes, I was. It was a couple of years after the Motel 6. Some guy in my office was having his bachelor party in Vegas, so about a dozen of us headed out there in a plane. This time, somebody had the foresight to reserve rooms at the Mirage. Of course, after dinner and bouncing around a few casinos, the last stop had to be the Crazy Horse. I get bored with Vegas after a couple of hours. The lights and plastic fantastic architecture and fountains and volcanoes, they're fun to look at. And so are the freaky people. But then what? And casino gambling never really interested me. And I've never been a fan of strip joints. Are the women hot? Sure. They're also often horribly fucked up. Lots have drug habits, many have kids, and the joints are usually run by mob hoods or outlaw bikers. And what the hell's the point of look, don't touch? Maybe fans of strip joints are masochists. They pay to be frustrated. That night, one guy dropped a few grand in $1 and $5 bills. That's a lot of G-string tucks. I thought he was a fucking idiot. After a couple hours at the Crazy Horse, I took a cab back to the hotel. Now, why am I telling you this? Because in the thumbnail for this episode, you were promised songs, stories, and pole dancers. And I never promise what I can't deliver. But the Crazy Horse is not the pole dancing story, no. That story occurred many years prior and a couple thousand miles east of Vegas in a place called Sunnyside, Queens. Sunnyside was kind of a crappy area. There were way more dangerous places, but it was just depressing. I never really stopped in Sunnyside, just passed through it on my way elsewhere. Until one bitter cold night when I was maybe a junior in college, a very close pal of mine, Bobby, had been going out with Diane. Diane was very sexy. She seemed a lot more mature than Bobby, more worldly, more experienced. She was hot-looking, swarthy, with a killer body. Thick brown hair, always in a ponytail. She wore glasses, which gave her that librarian sex bomb aura. Bobby thought he had found his soulmate. His friends thought otherwise. We thought he'd found a chick that enjoyed a good time, which Bobby could provide. He was a charm bomb and a major personality, but a chick like Diane was certain to meet lots of guys like Bobby, and some with deeper pockets. On this winter's night, I was awakened by the phone, which was in my parents' bedroom. I heard my old man pick it up. Next thing I know, he's standing in the door of my room telling me the call is for me. What the fuck? I run downstairs in my underwear and take it in the kitchen. When I pick it up, it sounds like hell is calling. Or maybe some insane asylum. An overdriven Tito Puente tune from a busted buzzing jukebox speaker and raucous voices and curses in Spanish and English. Above the din, I hear Bobby slurring his words, something about Diane and love, and he's so fucked up, his life is over, and can I come pick him up? He's out of money, and he doesn't want to call his family. I glance at the west clock in the hollow above the sink. It's 2:20 a.m. I push aside a blade of the Venetian blind. The window is caked with frost, and the cold off it vaporizes my breath. Yeah. Inside the house. I ask Bobby where the fuck he is, and he says something about a different world, and I'm thinking, oh great, he's hallucinating. Or maybe he's really lost his shit and had a fistful of pills. But that was never his style, or with any of my friends, we liked our beer and liquor, but drugs, those were verboten. I asked him again about the different worlds, and then he shouts, Sunnyside and Queens Boulevard, and suddenly it clicks. There was a strip joint in that area, a bucket of blood shithole, a place notorious for knifings and strippers that could transmit crabs with a mere flip of their hair. It was a portal of hell, of all the places to drown his sorrows. And he was never a strip club guy either. He must have been non compos mentis when he arrived there. Bobby was a good friend. We'd been through many an adventure together. I told him to sit tight. I figured it would take about 20 minutes to get there, but told him I'd see him in 30 because I was allowing for winter fuckery. As I hung up the phone, Mom appeared in her bathrobe. She had that look on her face, asked me if I was going to whatever place that call had come from. I told her it was Bobby, and he was drunk, and I just needed to retrieve him and get him back to his house. Mom shook her head and hugged me like I was heading off to war. The analogy wasn't much of an exaggeration. I pulled on my fry boots and jeans and zipped up my faux-shielding bomber jacket, the same one I'd worn through much of high school and nearly all of college. Out into the New York night, it was definitely in the low teens. My breath plumed like a bison at Yosemite. It had been a snowy, cold winter, and Queens roads were several inches deep with ice. I walked a few blocks until I reached the car. It must have been sleeting earlier. It was covered in ice. I stuck the key in the lock, but it would not turn. Luckily, it was a windless night. I pulled out my Zippo, held the car key to the flame for a long time. I stuck it into the door lock and twisted. I could feel it melting the ice. And finally, the lock popped. I sat on the frigid bench seat and turned the ignition. I switched on the defroster, which would be useless until the engine was hot. Then I grabbed the ice scraper off the floor and went back outside to start on the windshield. The roads were deserted. The rest of the world, the non-drunken, drugged-out, fucked-up, or broken-hearted world, was home in bed. The only other vehicle I saw on Queens Boulevard was a city bus. There was not a single passenger in it, just the driver, who was happily bopping his torso with his Sony Walkman earphones clamped around his skull. The late shift. He actually stopped at a bus stop where no one was waiting. Opened the doors so no one could exit. Shut the doors and drove on. Procedure. It was Christmas time, as I recall a few days after Christmas, after Bobby had given his beloved Diane a 14-karat gold bracelet that probably cost him a month's pay from his part-time job. The worst part of Christmas, the anticlimactic aftermath of disappointment and broken dreams and shattered romances. Some row houses and small businesses had made the Yuletide decoration effort, but it was in the typical New York half-assed, who-gives-a-shit manner. Lights hanging on a 40-degree slant from rain gutters. Frosty the Snowman with a fist-sized hole in his head, and the bulb inside flickering a message in Morse code.
I'm nearly dead, and I'm glad.
A plastic nativity scene scattered across the sidewalk like bowling pins after a strike. Finally, I arrived. I could hear the place before I got out of my car. In front of the bar lay a runt of a Christmas tree in the gutter, a few strands of tinsel catching the red neon from the strip joint. I got out of the car and braced myself. Who names a strip joint two different worlds? Maybe someone with a great sense of humor and irony. I'd driven past the place hundreds of times, but never imagined I'd be visiting at nearly 3 a.m. As I pulled open the glass door, the noise hit me along with a cloud of cigarette smoke and the stench of stale whiskey and beer. The bar was on the right, only a few asses on stools. Atop the bar stood a stripper. She was topless and well past her prime. Her dancing amounted to tapping a foot, out of boredom, I guess. Toward the back was a pool table. It was covered with plywood, and above the plywood was another stripper, younger, topless, and wearing dark knee socks with her clear heels. What a peculiar outfit. Maybe she was going for that schoolgirl look that some guys like. As my eyes adjusted to the light, I saw the truth. She was not wearing knee socks. She simply did not shave from below her knees. Her leg hair was that thick. This indeed was a different world, a sideshow in the carnival of hell. Where the fuck was Bobby? Over my shoulder, I heard a slurred, "Lorenz." That's what Bobby always called me. He was tucked in a booth, looking like shit warmed over. I told him to get up. It was time to go. He said if he did, he was going to puke. Oh, good. A new wrinkle. I suggested we go outside where the puking would be better. That's when he clapped a hand over his mouth and ran for the toilet. I followed him. And the can was a third different world. A urinal with a soccer ball-sized chunk missing. A toilet with no seat, no stall, nothing. It probably hadn't been flushed since 4th of July. There was no sink. Bobby just hurled in the direction of the toilet, and I backed through the door to avoid any overspray. I made a mental note to leave my boots outside when I got home. Soon Bobby seemed to be all out of vomit. On the way out, he begged me to buy him a 7-Up to settle his stomach. I didn't want him puking in my car, so I agreed. We sat on the bar stools, and I ordered 2 7-Ups. In the bottles, please. I wasn't putting any glasses to my lips in this joint. The bartender handed them over, and then the stripper came clocking down the bar in her platforms and decided to dance, if you could call it that. I never even looked at her. All I wanted was to get Bobby home to his family and get my ass back in my own warm bed. This stripper's knees were like 9 inches from my face, and she's bumping and grinding, expecting a buck in her G-string, I guess. That's when I did something really stupid. I stretched my arms and yawned. She leaned over, got right in my face, and shrieked,
"Am I fucking keeping you awake?"
Then I said something even more stupid. I said, "No." That lit her fuse. She kicked my drink across the room, then Bobby's, then did the Bristol stomp the length of the bar, kicking ashtrays, glasses, and bottles as she screamed, like a banshee getting a fire enema. I grabbed Bobby and dragged him outside, threw him in my car, and tore out of there. On the ride home, he gave me the download. Earlier that day, Diane dumped him. She had met the lead singer of, at that time, a very popular rhythm and blues act, big time. He had taken her to Saks Fifth Avenue, handed her his American Express gold card, and said, "Pick anything." This was on the first floor, where fine jewelry was very fine. I said nothing. Having already been a bartender for quite some time, I knew it was unwise to converse with drunks. Just let them talk. They're not listening anyway. Before we got to his house, I asked him if he was going to get the bracelet back from her. He looked as if he was having some kind of epiphany. Then he said, "No, man, that was a gift." I wanted to punch him in the side of his head, but I didn't. I helped him to his door and opened it for him, and after that, he was in the custody of his mom and dad, who were wonderful people. I hoped he was finished puking. I've not seen Bobby in a long, long time. The band the dude fronted turned out to be a one-hit wonder. Who knows where the fabulous Diane is or what pawn shop now displays the 14-carat bracelet. Two different worlds is probably a Starbucks. Another place I refuse to visit, for different reasons. Some things never change. I know I promised pole dancers, but I think a stripper with stylable leg hair and another that went apeshit compensates for the lack of a pole. I almost forgot I promised a song. This one, like the previous two, is all me and my guitars, no karaoke or backing track. I did have one on Scandal Claws because I don't have a horn section. This song is called Joey, the Soup-Brained Leader. If you dig it, visit thatlarryshow.com, click the PayPal or Patreon button, and make a donation. It's almost Christmas, for Christ's sake. Thank you. And thank you for coming out on this cold and snowy night to the lounge of thatlarryshow.com. Hey, it's almost Christmas. Here's a little something to get you in that Yuletide spirit. You know Putin and Trudeau, Macron and Zelensky, Orban, Maduro, Meloni and Xi. But can you understand
the most famous leader in this land. Joey the supreme leader.
I got hairy legs.
Always has 10-yard stare. And if you look a bit closer, you might say he's not all there.
I learned about roaches.
All of the other leaders laugh at him behind his back. They watch his every movement, wondering when his face will crack. Botox, hair plugs, and porcelain teeth cannot disguise his age. And if he misses his noontime nap, oh, nothing can stop his rage.
What I said.
By 7 o'clock, it's day's end. Dr. Jill will tuck him in. She'll button up his PJs as he steps into some fresh depends.
Watch me.
Joey the supreme leader likes to think he's in control.
I don't know.
But mostly he's just napping till they dose him up with Adderall. When they turn on those cameras, Joey sputters, blinks, and stares until that hot shot kicks in. That's when he becomes aware. Then he shakes his fists and shouts as if he is King Kong. After this speech, when it's time to chill out, he can take a hit from Hunter's bomb. All the smooth brains love him, even though he makes no sense. Ah, Joey the supreme leader, his brain is so smooth and dense. Joey the supreme leader, his brain is so smooth and dense.
But I'm gonna wrap this chain around your head.